You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, the story of the musician Michael O'Shea, who played an instrument which he made himself from a door that he found in a skip and released one album in 1982, which is now regarded as a landmark cult classic. No Journey's End is presented by Paul McDermott.
One evening in the late 70s, Rita O'Shea was walking through Dublin city centre with a friend. As they approached College Green, they came upon a large crowd surrounding a busker. As they drew closer, Rita realised that the musician who was holding this crowd spellbound was none other than her younger brother, Michael.
And there he was outside the Bank of Ireland, playing. Big crowd around him.
So you came upon this?
I was a bit embarrassed.
Why?
I don't know, because he was on the street playing. At that stage, busking really wasn't as common as it is now, you know, and to see your own brother outside the bank with all these people around him, to me, it was nearly like begging.
Yeah.
I know he wasn't begging as such, he was playing music, but on the street.
Did you go away or did you wait till he was finished to talk to him?
Well, I waited a little bit. Oh, there was someone with me, so I wasn't going to identify. No, I couldn't disturb him anyway. But I could have said, that's my brother, and I didn't. And that was bad of me.
Yeah.
Because we were slightly... I don't want to say I was ashamed of him. I wasn't.
Of course.
But it was unusual.
Yeah.
And to have your brother on the street playing, yeah. It wasn't as acceptable, possibly more acceptable in London than here in Holy Catholic Ireland. Very different.
Michael O'Shea was a travelling street musician who played to crowds in cities all over Europe. Larry Burns, Michael's friend, remembers how Michael could hold an audience's attention wherever he was.
You don't ask for attention. You don't even say cueness. You demand attention. And I knew at that instant that he was a master musician. Because a master musician demands attention before he even plays a note. And Michael always did that. And how did he do it? He had a friend. And what was that friend? O'Cara. He made it. And you probably got it when you first heard him. Well, you were gobsmacked. He broke down barriers everywhere he went. He demanded full attention and respect. And he got it like that.
Was a stringed instrument made by Michael from part of an oak door that he found in a skip in Munich. It was a hybrid between a sitar and a hammered dulcimer, but to this he added a number of effects and amplification. When Michael struck the instrument with small paintbrushes, the sound produced had the power to stop people in their tracks. Crowds would gather around and stare open-mouthed. The sound was steeped in Celtic undertones, but also reverberant with the cultures Michael had absorbed on his travels in the Far East. Michael travelled the streets of Europe playing experimental music. He performed in Ronnie Scott's infamous jazz club, and he supported Ravi Shankar at the Royal Festival Hall. He played with some of the biggest names in jazz, including Archie Shepp, Alice Coltrane and Don Cherry. And he also recorded one of the most extraordinary albums ever by an Irish musician that finally, almost 40 years after its original release, is getting its just acclaim. Michael's music has a dreamlike, almost mystical quality to it. Graeme Lewis, one of the producers of Michael's record, says that the experience of witnessing Michael in the studio was highly emotional.
I remember looking round the control room and basically everybody was in tears, you know. It was really, really moving.
Michael's album has recently been reissued, but sadly Michael isn't around to bask in the glory of the five-star reviews. He died in tragic circumstances at the young age of 44. This is No Journey's End, the story of Michael O'Shea. So, do you recognise the place, Dano?
Yeah, I remember the driveway here, the beautiful trail and driveway, and particularly the front of the house here, which would have stuck in my mind.
And you'd walk up from the bus stop?
Yeah, the bus stop is, you can actually, I was watching the bus here when I pulled in, directly across the road, so the bus would just stop here and we'd walk up and go in through the main gates here.
Back in the early 80s, Dano, had you any idea when you came to record here that the house had this long history, Robert Emmett, the Emmett family?
No.
Well, come on, we'll go in and we'll try and find where the old studio was.
Okay.
Robert Emmett House in Milltown was originally called Casino House, and from the late 1770s was the residence of the Emmett family. After the 1798 rebellion, Robert Emmett is said to have escaped capture by using an elaborate system of tunnels under the house. In 1920, the house was sold to the Marist Fathers, and by the late 70s, a Philemon recording studio was installed, Alto Studios, on Lornid Technoliacta Idicus Chorinta, the Centre for Educational Technology Limited. By day, Alto produced educational film strips, such as Colmagus Nula, but on downtime, the studio became the playground of Dublin's post-punk community. Stano recorded his acclaimed debut album, Content to Write In, I Dine Weathercraft, at Alto in late 1982, and Michael O'Shea guested on the record. It seemed appropriate that myself and Stano should return to Milltown.
Come on in.
Robert Emmett House is now home to the joint managerial body, Secretariat of Secondary Schools. Bernadette Kinsler of the JMB kindly invited myself and Stano on a tour of the house.
So this is where Robert Emmett escaped from here, out of the building. This was the escape route underneath, out into the garden.
Okay.
Way back right. In the day.
With Bernadette leading us through the house, we finally found the location of the old Alto studio.
This room, I recognised it because of the big square here, so...
Yeah, so it's where the control room and the studio met.
Yeah, the studio met, so it would have been... You looked down a bit on it, so... Yeah, that's where we'd done the recording.
How does it feel being back, Stano?
Yeah, strange. I remember the front of the house really, really clearly, you know. Really, it was like countryside when I first came here, so...
As myself and Stano sat and chatted in what had once been Alto Studios' control room, the memories of recording his debut album came flooding back. Stano told me all about meeting Michael for the first time in Dublin city centre.
I was coming up Grattan Street one day and I heard this music drifting on the wind. Couldn't figure out where it was coming from. It was magical. And eventually I traced them up to a doorway in Grattan Street. So I just stood there listening, mesmerised for maybe 20 minutes. And then I introduced myself to him. We did a bit of a conversation, told him what I was doing. And I said, I'd love to come in the studio, would you be interested? And he said yes. So
Michael agreed to play his Machara on Stano's album. And they arranged to meet again and travel out on the bus to Alto Studios in Milltown.
And when I seen Michael, I knew he did look different, but I looked different as well because I had multicoloured hair and I was a punk, like, you know. Very gentleman, very mild-mannered. I didn't really know what to expect. And a few people said to me, oh, he won't turn up in the studio. He won't, you know. He was on time. He was there waiting for me outside Trinity, and we came out of the bus. He had that sort of Hare Krishna or Indian type long sort of cream, sort of almost like what the Indian men wear. I don't know what you call them. And he had a bald head, shaved head, and he was fairly thin, but he looked sort of, you know, very, very strange. So I say we were a sight coming out on the bus, the pair of us, you know. With Michael's stuff, he had a lot of effects. He used to play through phases and delays. The room downstairs, because it was like a big gymnasium, had beautiful acoustics in it. And just when he struck the instrument, I just thought, geez, this sounds really, really nice. You know, on the tape itself, I would have just picked certain pieces that I liked and put it together that way, like a collage, really.
Michael O'Shea was born in Newry on the 11th of July 1947. Michael was the youngest of four, and the family lived in Carlingford, where Michael's father, Garda Jimmy O'Shea, was stationed. Tragedy struck the family when Michael was just a three-year-old and his father suffered a brain tumour. Here Rita, Michael's sister, remembers that awful time for herself, her siblings and her mother Kathleen.
So Mike was only about, I think he was about three, when my father died. A lovely little fellow with a head of curls. Cute. That was the way we were, but we were a very united family. My mum was very creative and looked, cared for us very well. She was from Sneem. They wanted her to come back to Sneem, but she wasn't. She was too independent. She wanted her own life.
And your father was a guard?
He was a guard, yeah.
He was from Kerry as well, wasn't he?
Yes, he was from Ventry. A very tall, good-looking man, very gentle apparently, but I don't have too many memories of him. But from listening to my mum, he was so kind that on his deathbed he said to her, "You buy yourself a washing machine. You'll need it." That's the way he was.
Rita can recall a very happy childhood in Carlingford with her mother and siblings, and said that Michael always seemed to have his head stuck in a book.
My sister, she couldn't believe that he was able to read those kind of books. Like Children of the New Forest, all these books, and he was only very young. I think he was okay at primary school, you know. There was no worries about him. He never mitched or anything like that. It was when he went to secondary school.
Michael attended St Michael's, the Rosminian College in Omeath, and all seemed to be going well, until one day a letter arrived.
Mum got a letter from the head of the college and saying that Mike really was missing quite a lot from school. This was, I think, in his intercert year. He was heading off into Newry, having a good time. We don't know who he was meeting or anything like that. But it was after that he joined the army, the British Army.
Was that a big shock at home?
I think so. My mother was all mortified, and he did it all quietly himself. He was very capable. That's what he wanted. And he wanted to see the world.
Now, you have a beautiful photograph here, Rita, of Mike as the passing out.
That was his passing out, yeah. My mum did go up. She supported us, didn't matter what we did. She was there for us. He did very well, very light and very good. And he became a corporal it wasn't too long after he had joined.
He's a fine-looking man in a uniform. Mm.
Yes, he was definitely a ladies' man. The girls liked him a lot.
And he was stationed in Germany then?
Yes, and he was all excited about that, going to Germany. And he loved it, and he used to write back to Mum, send her cards, every place he'd been. And then he was due to come home for Christmas. For some unknown reason, they cancelled his leave. When he did get the leave, he came home, had a lovely holiday, and then he was on his way back. His best friend growing up, Paul, he must have been in contact with him, and he met up with him. He was having a good time with him, and he met a girl, and that was it, fell in love. He got his punishment for it. I think he got a few months behind bars.
Court-martialed.
Yes, and that was the end of the army for him.
Michael had gone absent without leave and received a dishonourable discharge.
He went to London. I used to meet up with him every now and then if I went over to London. I have to say I had good times with him in the folk clubs. I was quite like him in many ways, really, except I wanted to work and he wanted to play. So there was a difference there.
After Michael was thrown out of the army, he did a number of odd jobs before eventually working at London's infamous Eel Pie Island Club, falling in with Ewan McCall and Peggy Seeger and immersing himself in the folk revival. Around this time, international attention was focused on the genocide that took place during the Bangladesh War of Independence and the subsequent relief effort for refugees. Michael and a friend decided to travel to Bangladesh with the London-based humanitarian group Operation Omega.
He had many, many friends in London that I do know, and one of them was Frankie, and she was a social worker, and he thought the world of her, and she of him, but she was very good to him, and she influenced him quite a lot. And that's when he decided to go to Bangladesh. They were in a dreadful way and they were looking for people, yeah, volunteers to go out. He decided, yes, I'm going to Bangladesh. So off he went. And all the letters he used to send Mum were all very happy letters. He loved it out there. But then he got dysentery, okay, and hepatitis, and he had to come home. So he was like a rake when he came home, skin and bone.
You've some beautiful, yeah, photos here of him in Bangladesh.
That's right, yeah. Actually, he loved it and he loved the people very, very much. And he got into their culture in a big way, so much so that he started to learn the sitar. And when he eventually came home, he came home with all kinds of trinkets. But the biggest love he had was the sitar. The only bit I heard of with a sitar was Ravi Shankar. And I didn't know too much about him until, although he was in the charts, I think, you know, was an aide of Bangladesh.
I'd just like to say before we start off with the concert, to thank you all for coming here. As you all know, it's a special benefit concert. First part of the concert is going to be an Indian music section. So let me introduce on sitar Ravi Shankar.
And everywhere he went, that sitar went, even to my brother's wedding. Sitar took up a whole place in the car and we were squashed to bits. And he played the sitar.
And could he play it?
I don't know. Sure, I listened to him. And I thought, yeah, he was grand and he was playing away. But I didn't really know, yeah, what sound should be coming. But there was a sound coming anyway. And I think he impressed everybody. They didn't really know whether he was playing properly or not.
Michael learned how to play the sitar and then spent the next few years travelling throughout Europe playing music. Michael's old friend, the poet and musician Larry Burns, recalls that Michael understood the code of the road.
Michael never wanted to be rich and famous. Now, I mean this sincerely, but he didn't want money, or castles, or gold records. He invested in people, friendship, and he had it. And that's what I learned, the code of the road. He played Bowron, wonderful harmonica, played traditional Irish, Tibetan, gypsy. Beautiful shit, man. The girls loved him, you know.
Can you try and describe what Makara actually was?
It's a door that was thrown out. Took it out of a skip in Moonshin. And well, I tell you, he's playing with a guy called Halsop, who made his own instrument. Of course, Michael's quick on the draw. Michael played Bower on him. Sort of tabla rhythms, you know, exactly knows his music inside out. The second day, Michael came back with Makara. And he added an extra thing to it, stick a bit of an amplifier to it next minute.
So what was this strange instrument that Larry talks about? Well, here in Michael's own words is the story of how he created his Makara.
The instrument, Makara, Gaelic for my friend, is a combination of at least three instruments. The basic dulcimer shape was taken from an instrument designed and made by an Algerian musician, Chris Harpo, who accompanied me on his Zello chord when I was playing Indian sitar in France during the summer of 78. Having sold my sitar in Germany and being desperate for money to travel to Turkey, I conceived of the idea of combining both sitar and Zello chord. The first Makara was born, taken from the middle of a door which was rescued from a skip in Munchen, Germany. 3 days later, I was playing Makara Mark I in Greece for a living. The second and most important development began when I returned to the UK in 79 and made Mark II. Keeping the original Zello chord zitar sound, I added the sound from another instrument which I had invented, the Black Hole Space Echo Box. And to finish the new Makara, I added amplification and electronics. Michael O'Shea, 1982. Thank you.
Michael's Macara was inspired by a hammered dulcimer, but instead of the usual small mallets, Michael struck the strings with small paint brushes. And though the dulcimer has been played in Irish trad, and the instrument is closely associated with the Glens of Antrim and the music of John Ray, its origins are in the Middle East. A Hawk and a Hacksaw are a folk duo from Albuquerque, New Mexico, featuring Jeremy Barnes and Heather Trost. Over the course of six albums, the band have showcased their love of Eastern European folk music to audiences all over the world. On the band's last two records, Jeremy has played a dulcimer. They recently played in Dublin, and I went to speak to them about the instrument.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, it's pretty much, it'll do.
Great.
For Irish radio. Yeah. I'm Jeremy Barnes from A Hawk and a Hacksaw, and I've been playing the Persian centaur, which is one of the more ancient versions of the dulcimer, for about 8 years. As a drummer, it just seemed natural to me. You're hitting strings with sticks.
I asked Jeremy what he thought of Michael's music.
I could hear some like echoes of Irish music or some kind of influence in there of Irish music, but it also sounded very Eastern. I was really impressed with his technique and his ability to put together melodies. Also, the sound of the instrument was really beautiful, and I didn't know it was homemade at that time. I did some research, and I was amazed that he built it with a door. I mean, it sounds great. You know, I don't know how he did it. He had like a flanger or something on it. I think it would be really intriguing to see live. I wish I could have seen him play. This Persian version of it is 18 bridges. And on each bridge is four strings. They're tuned to the same note, so kind of like on a piano. This is tuned to the Hijaz scale, which is a really popular Middle Eastern and Balkan and Turkish scale. It's really portable, and it's super light, so it's really nice to travel with. I think the same with Michael. He traveled all over playing it, and the difference in that and the sitar, where it's like as big as you, and you can't really get around with it easily. I think we both were attracted to the instrument for that reason. I guess I'll just do a little improvisation for you. Well, it's ancient. I think maybe that's part of it, is that it's...
What do you think of it, Heather, when you hear it?
Yeah, it's it makes the hair on my arms graze up, you know? It's like this, like you said, this sort of ancient sound that, I don't know, it's almost like primal or something.
Yeah, that's a good description.
Heather there from A Hawk and a Hacksaw describing the dulcimer's sound as something primal. Now, during the late 1970s, Michael would travel all over Europe playing his Macara. It may have been more acceptable to busk in London, and it was also where Michael cut a break. He was spotted busking in a tube tunnel by Belfast man Will Sproul. Sproul was a booking agent for the infamous Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. In February 1980, Sproul told Jerry Lawless, the Sunday World's London correspondent, how Michael ended up with a residency in Ronnie Scott's.
I was stopped in my tracks. In 10 years in the music game, I had never heard sounds like this before. It appeared to be a mixture of Ravi Shankar and a sitar, and a Sean O'Ria the arrangement of traditional Irish music, crossed with Japanese koto music. When I got to the front of the crowd, I discovered a funny little man playing a strange instrument, the likes of which I had never seen before. I asked Michael if he had half an hour to spare and parked him in the bar of the club, then ran upstairs to the office to ask Ronnie to come down and hear a strange man play strange music on a weird instrument. I think Ronnie thought I had flipped, but he came down and listened for a few minutes and then said, book him for the first opening.
And as if playing in Ronnie Scott's wasn't enough, it led to a concert, opening for the one and only Ravi Shankar at Royal Festival Hall.
Support to Ravi at
one stage. He did in Festival Hall. We couldn't believe it. We were shocked. This was all news to me later, you know. We just couldn't believe that he would be playing in Royal Festival Hall. That was after he was playing in Ronnie Scott's. I think he got a contract there, but he broke the contract. He had no staying power. He was a free spirit and he was like a rolling stone. And I don't know if he ever knew where he was heading, to be quite honest with you. It was just happening, whereas most of us plan our lives. He didn't seem to have too much of a plan. I did notice in one of his passports, and I couldn't stop laughing at it, he had decided he was a doctor of music. But Dr. O'Shea, well now, big ideas, that's what I say. Loved dressing up in all kinds of manner.
You've a great photograph there of him dressed up as the town's choir.
Yes, oh yeah. Oh, when he dressed up, he was quite handsome.
What does it say there, Rita?
Taken on the day Prince Charles and Di got married in the garden of my previous home. This is my country square image. You can show it to your friends.
And how would you describe him in the picture, Rita?
Well, he looks really well. Actually, he looks quite like my father. You know, if I look at photographs of my father.
Yeah.
He was Dr. O'Shea, doctor of music. Oh, like he had high thoughts for himself. Unbelievable.
Anyway, our next guest tonight comes to us straight from the world-famous Ronnie Scott Jazz Club in London, where he's just completed a successful tour.
Michael's residency in Ronnie Scott's and the subsequent interview in the Sunday World led to an appearance on Irish television. On the 22nd of February 1980, Michael was interviewed by Mike Murphy on an episode of The Live Mike.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael O'Shea.
Michael, looking really smart in shirt and tie and white sweater with a striped scarf draped over his shoulders, sits at a stool behind his machara. He smiles nervously as he's introduced by Mike, then sticks his paintbrushes in his ears, eliciting a laugh from the live audience. It's a light-hearted interview, as befitting the style of the programme. Mike asks questions about busking, finding the door, Ronnie Scott's, but then turns serious and asks Michael if he always harboured musical ambitions.
Had you always wanted to become recognised as a top-class musician?
Not particularly, but I felt that my music was going in a direction which was becoming a recognisable music in my own right, because...
It certainly is an unusual direction. There is no...
The segment ends with Mike asking Michael to play his machara.
Well, you certainly can.
We'd love to hear you. So now,
I hope it works. He's got a mind of his own.
Listen, what do you mean you hope it works? This better work after that introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael O'Shea.
Thank you.
Michael used to regularly busk in London. He could be found in different tube stations, and a regular pitch of his was in Covent Garden. By the late 1970s, Covent Garden's fruit and vegetable markets had closed down, and a community of artists, musicians, photographers, and members of different craft associations were moving into the area. Tom Johnston had an office on James Street in Covent Garden. He remembers meeting Michael.
I'm Tom Johnston. In 1975, I first met Michael O'Shea. He was busking in a street in Covent Garden. At the time, I was trying to be a cartoonist, a political cartoonist, which I eventually became for the Mirror and the London Evening Standard. I was also starting to get involved with music, and we formed the band The. And I hope you listen to Michael's record.
I met up with Tom on a bright and busy Saturday afternoon in Belfast, and he described his memories of meeting Michael.
He was busking, yeah, and eventually he was like busking there a lot, and he was dressed in a kind of a tweed suit with a trilby on. Other days you'd turn up and be dressed as a woman, you know, it was no rules to him whatsoever. I liked him, and he seemed vulnerable, and I didn't consciously think that, but I think that's probably why I picked up on him, besides the fantastic music. Well, he had been in India and Far East, and so I think that influence was there, but through it was this big kind of solid rod of Celtic stuff, and I could hear it all there. And he invented that thing himself, that instrument. He found a door and skip and built it. He added lots of electronic effects on it. I think that's what made it more ethereal and heavenly sounding. But there's no one else like him.
Another person who used to also see Michael busking in London was Gavin Friday.
My name is Gavin Friday. I'm a former Virgin Prune. I formed the Virgin Prunes in 1977 in Dublin. And since those days have still been and still am involved in music, the arts, and God knows what else. I had seen him busking near tube stations usually, but what was extraordinary about this, it's almost like he looked like a sort of a, there's a great scene at the end of The Man who Fell to Earth, where Bowie, and he had the big hat and the suit, and he just drops the head, and obviously he's turned into this doomed alcoholic, and it just ends with the head dropped, this stylish man. And I walk him by and I see this hat and this stylish man in a suit sitting on the ground playing this crazy thing that I didn't know what it was, like a xylophone meets a slide guitar or one of those country and western guitars. And the sound was quite like, it was like psychedelic but Gaelic but Philip Glass, but it was a bit of everything, but it was very, what the fuck is that? And it was in, I think it was Notting Hill when I first saw him. There was sightings of him. I never went near him or at that stage. I just found him incredibly mysterious. And then just this dreamlike magic. And I've never really heard anything like it before. Again, I've never really seen anyone play those instruments in the way he did.
Two others who came into Michael's orbit around this time were Graham Lewis and Bruce Gilbert, members of the seminal post-punk UK band Wire. By the early 80s, Wire were on a hiatus, with individual members working on different projects. Graham and Bruce were recording as Dome. Here, Graham recalls one particular night when he met a mysterious busker.
Bruce and I, we used to drink in the White Lion. It was kind of our office, and just around the corner from Sounds, the magazine, we were in the Lion. And I went outside, I think to smoke a fag, actually.
As Graham stood outside the pub smoking a cigarette, he heard a sound.
Mellifluous sound, music. It was quite mysterious, you know what I mean? Because I couldn't work out where it was coming from. So my sort of followed the sound, and it was a clothes shop which had, they've just finished fitting it out. So you know how the shop windows sort of funnel out, and sitting in there in this extremely effective, what should we call it, sand funnel, was a figure which he was sitting on an amplifier, head bowed, crouched over what turned out to be a machine, a stringed machine. And this figure was wearing black court shoes. I think they were white stockings, a white pleated pencil skirt, a navy blue blazer with big gold buttons, a white turban, and very large hooped earrings. And this person was producing this absolutely extraordinary noise. And the figure didn't look up.
Graham returned to the pub and convinced Bruce to come back with him to the shop doorway to witness the mysterious figure and his strange music.
And it wasn't looking up when we got back down there again. Anyway, we stood and watched for a while, and the figure did actually look up at one point, and we were quite surprised. It was very difficult to tell what gender the person was. We'd gone back to the pub then for another pint, and I think it was something like the next day, because we saw Tom quite often. You know, I was recounting to Tom what I'd seen, and of course Tom went, ah, ha, ha, you know, that's Michael O'Shea.
Graham and Bruce met Michael on a few other occasions and eventually offered to record an album with him.
We thought what we might be able to do is capture what he was doing. And this is not an exaggeration. Before, we thought Michael might die or, you know, disappear to wherever else. I don't know. But what we came up with was, we said to Michael, look, we record in the studio called Blackwing, which is between Borough and London Bridge. It doesn't exist anymore now. And we were recording with a guy called Eric Radcliffe there.
Blackwing Studios closed in 2001, but it remained synonymous with a number of bands who recorded there in the early 80s. Depeche Mode, Yazoo, and Cocteau Twins, among others. After Graham and Bruce had offered to record Michael at Blackwing, he explained to them that his turning up, or indeed his even wanting to record, very much depended on the alignment of the planets and these being in a favourable combination for him.
You know, this was knowledge that was alien to Bruce and myself, but Michael assured us this was essential for his activities. So we said, well, fair enough, you know. And we gave him the address and said, you know, that's where we might be. It was a beautiful summer, as I remember it, and one day, sitting in the garden at the back door of the studio, was Mr. O'Shea, sort of sitting there in the sun, smoking a fag, saying, the planets are right. So I was like, well, that's terrific, you know. So I got inside. Basically, we just said to Eric, he plays this instrument, it's like this, it's like that. Can you set up as many microphone positions, recording situations as you can? And we'll see if we can, you know, capture this incredible noise. We got Michael in and, you know, tried to get him comfortable, cup of coffee, and he rolled himself a wiggly woodbine, and so everything was, it was quite tense. Everybody was, of course, trying to be very relaxed. So anyway, Michael got up and he said he just had to go for a walk. So he'd gone off for a walk in the garden and sort of, I think, he smoked a spliff. And when he came back, he sat down and sort of in his usual way went, right, now this is it. And so he sat down and he proceeded to play No Journey's End, which is whatever one wants to call it, the distillation of what he did, I think, really. It was like his theme tune, his story, if you like. And it was always improvised, so you never knew quite where it was going to go. And it really had to catch with him, you know what I mean, where you could get lost in it. He recorded what everybody's heard, which is like 17 minutes, you know, and it is as it is. It was absolutely extraordinary. It's still one of the most magical recording experiences I've had. I remember looking around the control room, and basically everybody was in tears. You know, it was quite really, really moving.
Author and broadcaster Eamon O'Cahan wrote for In Dublin in the early 80s. Here he recalls reviewing Michael's album for the magazine.
I was the folk reviewer for In Dublin magazine at the time, so I did get sent a lot of obscure items. But I do remember writing what I've written here and being very enthused about it at the time. I was looking him up this morning on a website called Discogs, and both the original album is listed there, now worth over €150, and the new version, which came out in January this year, is also listed there. And there's a lot of people basically echoing what I wrote. So very impressed by it and very taken with the music. So that kind of indicates what I wrote.
But just what did Eamon think of Michael's album all those years ago?
Michael O'Shea, as he will tell you on the cover, is the son of an Irish policeman and has been in his time a hippie, a barman, a factory worker, a catalyst, and a leather craftsman, among a vast list of other things. Now, here I come to tell you that he is, in addition, a one-man Jeruti column and the creator of an exciting and fulfilling album. And not only that, he has invented the various instruments that he plays on the album. His latest, Machara, was originally conceived from the middle of an old door. The music, all self-composed, deserves the maligned words like atmospheric and cosmic. At times, the feeling is that achieved by Alan Stivell on his Renaissance of the Celtic Harp album. This remarkable record will please not only fans of folk music, but also fans, as it is tinged with rock overtones, perfumed with Eastern mysticism, and hallowed with Irishness. Eamon O'Cahan, In Dublin Magazine, July 1982.
Michael's album also picked up positive reviews in other publications, including this review, published in the April 1982 issue of Record Business magazine.
A fascinating, virtuoso performance by Irishman Michael O'Shea, who can often be seen busking in London's Covent Garden. His instrument is Mochara, literally my friend, a cross between a zelechord and a sitar in the shape of a dulcimer. It has an echo box and electronic amplification and is played by striking the strings with hammers. The sound is peculiar to the instrument, although borrowing from the basic tone of a sitar. The music is a rich, melodic progression, as fascinating as the electronic creations of Mike Oldfield.
Author and journalist Mark Prendergast had worked in a record shop in Dublin before writing about new music for the Irish Times. He remembers being sent a copy of Michael's album in 1982 and hearing the music for the first time.
All these labels like Cherry Red, 4AD, Factory, all this, started sending me records. You know, they'd send me weird stuff. And then one day this Michael O'Shea turned up and I said, what's this? And it sounded fantastic. It had the same effect on me, as I said, of hearing the music of Gurdjieff as transcribed by Thomas de Hartman in the early 20th century. Gurdjieff was an Armenian mystic who travelled all over the Far East and arrived in Paris in the early 20s and became a guru. But the music of Thomas de Hartman and Gurdjieff is very calligraphic, I would say, entrancing and soporific. It's basically like looking at Arabic design, the way they adorn their mosques and stuff in the Middle East, the tiny little details and tiles and worlds and worlds and worlds. That's the effect that the Michael O'Shea album had on me.
Later that summer, Mark met Michael in Trinity College's Fellow Square and interviewed him for issue 13 of Vox magazine.
As I remember, I actually wrote a piece for the Irish Times in Fellow Square there in front of the Lecky Library. When I met Michael there, he started playing me his music and I said, that sounds fantastic. I said, would you like to do an interview for the Irish Times? And he said, no problem. And we did the interview and I actually wrote the piece. It was rejected by the Irish Times. I still have the rejection ors written on it. Too obscure to have a big interview with him, which I thought was, well, you have an interview with all sorts. Why can't you have an interview with a great Irish musician as well? But so I kept that, and then Vox asked me to write something, and then I did another interview with Michael, and then Vox was great because Vox was totally new music, and it was really uncompromising. It was like one of these hardcore English punk fanzines, and they really covered the scene.
Mark had a lot of friends staying in rooms in Trinity College, and Michael would often turn up at a party and play for people. Here Mark describes how Michael looked.
Well, he was very small. He was slightly lurched over. He always wore a hat because he was bald, you see. He always carried his thing under his arm, and he had a shoulder bag with all the bits and pieces, you know, the amplifier. The black Echo space bag, which was basically just an electric kalimba, a thumb piano that they use in Africa. Of course, he always used to carry other instruments as well, which people don't mention. He used to carry a tin whistle. Sometimes he'd have a small, like, little banjo he'd carry. You know, he could play other instruments. The makara wasn't the only instruments he played. He was very wiry, and, you know, he was very hard to actually get him to sit down and stay in one place. You know, he'd just vanish and then come back half an hour later.
Though renowned for his busking exploits, Michael did also play the odd gig. On the 31st of October 1982, he performed in Cork's Ivernia Theatre at a Vox magazine-promoted night called Vox Cabaret. Jim O'Mahony was at the gig and met me on a wet and windy February morning on the Grand Parade in Cork.
Jim, how are you?
How are you, Paul?
Okay, across from the City Library at the top of Grafton Lane. As we made our way down the little laneway, Jim recalled the Vox Cabaret.
I do remember for definite that Michael Disney were in the bill. Michael O'Shea was on the bill. There was a few others. Remember the night itself? I don't think it actually went very smoothly or very straightforwardly. I think they were having problems with the sound and stuff, and people would attempt to play for a while. I think Michael O'Shea did actually get to play for a while. I'm not sure if anyone else managed to do a full set. Like, the Ivernia was weird. I think it was a square room. I remember you went in. The stage was kind of in front of you.
Okay.
We all seemed to go to the left and we were sitting on the floor against the walls. That's the memory I have of it.
Jim, I've never been down this laneway in all my years living in Cork.
Yeah, the last time I've been down here was probably that night.
Amazing. Yeah. Was it your first time ever hearing about Michael O'Shea?
I had heard of him because I used to buy Vox magazine, and he was always in Vox magazine, and I think Dave Fanning would have had the late night show at the time, and he used to play an awful lot of the guys in Vox, you know, like in Vox. Now, the staples of it would have been Five Go Down to the Sea, Michael Disney were always there, the likes of Stano, Michael O'Shea.
The Virgin Prunes.
The Virgin Prunes were like the poster boys. But now
the wind and rain is getting the better of us here, Jim. Jim, we've retreated out of the cold and the rain.
Into the bodega, yeah.
We were talking about Michael O'Shea. What do you remember of him that night, Jim?
I distinctly remember him sitting on the chair with the instrument on his lap, kind of going, oh, that's him, that's the guy there. The type of crowd that would have been there, like, you know, there was a small, really alternative, arty group of people that used to kind of hang around and go to these kind of gigs in Cork. So what he was doing musically would have made sense to a lot of people. Yeah. You had no footfall happening here. Nobody just walked in off the street and came across an impromptu Michael O'Shea gig. You might play that music to two people. One person will head for the hills, but you'll always get the person who'll stand there and who'll be overcome by it. And I think that, you know, that's what it does. If you were any way different or did anything different in Ireland, you were looked down upon and you know, you were kind of nearly ostracised. And the funny thing is now that years later, you have a lot of people coming from that scene who are revered. It's one of these records when you just have to pick the right person, put the record in their hand and say, look, you're going to have to trust me here. Take this and listen to it and tell me what you think. Just don't ask me any questions. Just sit down and have a listen to this. You honestly can't describe it. You have to tell somebody just to listen to it.
By the late 80s, Michael had all but stopped performing, concentrating his time on instrument making for others. Rita remembers that shortly before Christmas 1991, Michael had just alighted from a bus in London when tragedy struck.
And he walked behind the bus, straight out into a... There was a van coming, that was it. Now, the van wasn't going that fast, but whatever bump he got... Yeah. You know, he bled, he had a cerebral hemorrhage.
Okay.
And the sad part of it was he was in hospital for so many days and no one knew who he was. He had no identification on him.
So how did they identify him?
Apparently there was a nurse who knew him. She had met him at a party and she recognised him. Fluke. He was in King's College Hospital, I think.
They were able to contact
the family. Through the guards, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
So he lived for, I think, about maybe 4 days unconscious. And then they withdrew the life support. The morning I went over, I flew over then.
Surrounded by his family, Michael passed away on the 23rd of December, 1991. And he was a young man, wasn't he?
44. Hmm. Oh, it was very sad. Pardon me, it broke my mother's heart. Luckily enough, she was in London with my sister.
Yeah.
So we went up to his apartment, Noel and myself, and cleared out everything and took whatever we needed. And my sister took Macara, and she still has it. But it was very sad. And like his friends didn't know he was dead. No one knew. And it was so sad. So we had him cremated. Okay. But we had him brought back down to Ventry. And we had a mass said for him there and had him buried in the family grave.
Next to his father.
The father, yeah. So that's where Mike was laid to rest. So my mum is buried there now. So we often go down and see the grave.
It's nearly 40 years since Graeme Lewis first heard the strange sound of the Macara as he was standing outside a pub in Covent Garden.
There's something very Bechtian about it, you know what I mean? Its essence, you know, is something which has got this agelessness about it, but very much in the moment, you know. The thing that was extraordinary about what Michael was doing was that the instrument was amplified. You know, there was a lot of phasing and delay and things going on, which put this very sort of, what was a kind of very traditional music, but very much in... You know, in the present, in the early 80s.
Rita, Michael's sister, reflects now on how she feels about her brother.
Because he was different to any of us in the family, we found maybe hard to accept. And really, I think nowadays we would be more forgiving and more tolerant when we see how life is. Mm-hmm. But we were all kind of straight-laced, if you like.
Gavin Friday, to this day, finds Michael's music indescribable.
Feels like a one-man orchestra. And you get a sense. What's really interesting about it is the storytelling that Irish trad folk people can do. And Michael has that, in that it's like that solo performer that's playing with Machara, that he made it himself. So it has this fusion of stuff. The Indian shit brings on the psychedelia, but then it has that Celticness as well. He's like a sci-fi trad player. Yeah, that's a good analogy. That in the late 70s happened to look like the man who fell to earth busking.
I'm glad, really, that his music is being recognised. I really am. Because we didn't appreciate it. But other people did. But his music wasn't noisy. It was special. It was different. I always thought his music really was quite suited to background music of maybe some film or something. I often hear music similar on lyric and think, I wonder, is that him? That's the truth now.
And you've described him to me before, Rita, as a free spirit.
Well, that's what I would call him, a free spirit. You know, he was my brother and I loved him.
No Journey's End was written, presented and produced by Paul McDermott. It was a Learn and Sing production for RTE Lyric FM.